Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the 329th episode of Awards Chatter, the Hollywood Reporter's awards podcast. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and my guest today is one of Hollywood's brightest young stars, a 23-year-old who has quietly been doing outstanding work for over a decade on both the small screen, on TV series like FX's Justified and Fox's, formerly ABC's, Last Man Standing, and on the big screen, in films like Destin Daniel Cretton's Short Term 12, Jason Reitman's Men, Women, and Children, and Kathryn Bigelow's Detroit. But who, over the past year, took things to a whole nother level as a co-lead with Beanie Feldstein of the film Booksmart, Olivia Wilde's feature directorial debut and an instant comedy classic, and as the lead of the Netflix limited series Unbelievable, a rip from the headline show created by Susanna Grant, Ayelet Waldman, and Michael Chabon that was watched by 32 million people in its first month on the streaming service. Both of her projects were included on Barack Obama's list of personal favorites of 2019. The former landed her a BAFTA Award nomination in the EE Rising Star category, and the latter resulted in Golden Globe and Critics' Choice Award nominations for Best Actress in a Limited Series or TV Movie. I'm talking, of course, about Caitlin Dever. Over the course of our conversation, Dever and I discussed the odds-defying breaks that led her to Hollywood and the TV collaborators who helped to learn the ropes once she arrived, the tricks of the trade that she learned from her various film projects, how Booksmart, for which she had years to prepare, and Unbelievable, for which she had barely any time to prepare at all, changed the way that she looks at her work and at life overall, plus much more. And so, with great thanks to Caitlin, with a plea to our listeners to stay home, and without further ado, let's go to that conversation. All right, Caitlin, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. Good to have you. I guess to begin with, let me ask, where and how are you weathering this insanity?
I am at my parents'. I live at home, and I'm so grateful to be with family during this time. I don't know how I would be if I were just alone with my thoughts. So we are, you know, we're spending days by the pool and watching movies together, and I'm able to write a lot with my sister. And yeah, it's been good. It's been good.
Good. And we should just note, you and your sister, I am assuming you're referring to the music that you guys make together. You have a band, right?
Yes, we do. We do.
Okay. Well, I guess on this podcast, what we really do every episode is go back to the beginning of each guest's life and try to connect the dots. So just truly at the beginning, where were you born and raised, and what did your parents do at that time for a living?
I was born in Arizona. I was born in Phoenix, and my parents were figure skaters, and they grew up figure skating. They would compete, and they went on to coach figure skating. And I was born in Arizona, and then we moved to Texas when I was, I think they told me I was almost two, if not two already, because my sister Maddie had been born, and we're pretty close in age. And the reason why we moved to Texas was because my dad got the job to be the voice of Barney.
That is pretty cool.
And it's super. I love telling their story because I think it's kind of random, you know, going from figure skating and then doing voice acting. But yeah, my dad just, you know, got this random call he just heard randomly from a friend that they were doing a nationwide search for the new voice of Barney, and my dad ended up just randomly getting it. So that's what moved us to Texas. And I pretty much consider Texas my home, my hometown. I lived in The Colony, Texas, is where I grew up. And it was the best place to grow up. I'm so glad that I grew up there. Texas really, really shaped me and who I am as a person today. So I have a very, very like awesome childhood that I think back on a lot.
Yeah. Well, prepping for this, I obviously, read everything I can find about our guests. And one of the things that I came upon was that probably like most children, you had a lot of different hobbies and interests and stuff, but there was something that maybe you didn't stick with very many of them, but acting was the exception. Why was that? What was it about acting that even as a kid in Dallas hooked you?
Yeah, my family, you know, I remember doing a lot of different activities, as you do growing up. You know, you get, you know, you start doing gymnastics and ballet and soccer was one for me that I actually, one activity that I actually really, really enjoyed and I still kind of miss. But with acting, I think the reason why it hooked me was because I finally was able to get a fix on this like constant urge to make people laugh or be someone that I'm not all the time. And I was able to do that in acting classes, even though I remember thinking like, I love doing this so much. I love going to acting classes. This is just, I remember even coming home from the first acting class that I took in Texas. I remember thinking like, oh my, I just remember coming and telling my mom it was the best day ever. It was just, I've never had so much fun in my life. And, but it always made me so nervous. It genuinely made me like, it was a nerve wracking thing for me. But I think that I was so nervous because I actually cared and I never used to get nervous. And so I think I like lived off of the nerves of it, but also just being able to make people laugh and perform at such a young age was something that I just loved immediately.
It sounds like Dallas Young Actors Studio, was that the place you're referring to where you had initially started?
Yeah, it is.
And what was at that age, what age are we talking about here that you were there? Probably, what, like 6, 7, 8?
No, I was actually, I think I was closer to 9. I think I was 8 going on 9 because then I stayed at Dallas Young Actor Studio. I took classes there for about a year and they had a showcase of agents come and watch kids do monologues. And I think I remember doing a Skittles monologue and and then, you know, that on from there, then the story continues from there. But yeah, I did Dallas Young Actor Studio. It was the coolest place ever to learn all of just, I guess, the basics and everything you need to know. They have this whole sitcom setup in their studio, which was pretty cool. I loved going there. I took it I remember taking it very, 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 very seriously. And I thought, you know, when we would put on shows for our parents and parents would come down and watch like an episode of a sitcom that we would put mm-hmm. together, it would be like some serious business for me. And I took it very, very seriously. And I remember one time a video that still even haunts me to this day. We were doing a live, like it was like they were saying, okay, you know, they were teaching us about the idea that whatever happens in a show, the show must go on. You cannot break. You cannot do it. You just have to keep going, whatever happens. And they were really telling us this is live and you're doing it in front of people. And I remember I was the first one to come in. And I had to burst through the door and I had some exciting news and I burst through the door and I'm in the living room. And I remember I had just broken my arm too. Really doing well. First with me slicing my finger today and I broke my arm and I had this cast and I was running in and I ran in and I tripped so bad. Oh, I tripped so hard. And I remember turning beet red, and it's all on camera. They were filming it like a sitcom. And I remember being so beet red and just going, oh, what should I do? And I decided that the best thing to do was to turn to camera and say, sorry. And then continue the scene. And still, my parents keep that video just to play every once in a while. And it really is just, it still haunts me. And that is the biggest memory I have of Dallas Young Actors Studio. And it's a good memory, you know.
So was it, well, I don't know if this was the acting showcase that you were referring to a moment ago, but there was one day at some point where I guess really it was a life-changing thing where agents show up and say what?
They show up. They saw me do a couple of monologues, and this one agent in particular took me and my parents aside and said, "We think, you know, we want to represent her, and we want her to come out to LA and try auditioning for something."
How old were you at that point?
I was 9. I think I was 9 going on 10, because I remember once we came to LA, I was 10 years old.
And so what are your parents make of this? This is I guess that's what you kind of, were you working towards that, or was that even not even on the radar as something that
was not even on the radar? I think my parents, you know, after I had complained about gymnastics and ballet and whatever else, and I had such a scatterbrain that I think they thought that, oh, this is just another thing that she says. And that's the other thing too. I had been begging to do acting or go to class. I thought acting was something that you could just do. I thought you could just like be on TV like Lizzie McGuire and, you know, Christy Carlson Romano, the women I grew up watching on TV. I thought you could just do it. And, you know, so my parents, I think they thought, yes, I was having a good time, but I think that they had thought it just stopped there. So when this agent approached them, I think they thought, okay, well, this is literally insane. We can't just, I don't know what this person expects. We just like, what, drop everything and go to LA so she can audition for stuff. But then I always found it funny that I also knew about it. I thought that it would be interesting maybe to just approach the parents. But since I knew about it, I was really, really eager, and I was constantly talking about it and bringing it up. And my parents were always, and still to this day, have always been very, very, very supportive people, but also very realistic. And they're like, well, we want her to live her dream. She says this is her dream, and she doesn't want to do anything else with her life. And which that also is shocking to me. I still don't have an answer to that. I don't know why I knew what I wanted to do at such a young age, but I really did. And they wanted to support me, and they said, look, like, we'll do this.
Initially, just your mom, right?
Both my parents.
No, but I mean, in terms of, yeah, coming out, yeah.
It was initially my mom, and my sisters actually came with us, because we kind of thought, well, we'll just turn it into like a mini or like an extended vacation, I guess.
And this was like pilot season or something?
This was pilot season, yeah. Yeah, so the agent said, why don't you come out to pilot season and audition for some stuff and see how things go. And my parents, I remember them telling me, look, Caitlin, we're going to do this. We're going to try this, but you just have to know that this is going to be extremely difficult, and it is not going to be easy. And you are not going to book the first thing you go out on. And I remember getting an audition for a Mattel Barbie commercial. And I remember even thinking back on it, such a funny thing. It was such a big, there were so many people there, and I auditioned. I ended up getting a call back, and then I got a call like a month later that I had gotten it. So technically it was the first. I booked the first thing I went out on.
That doesn't happen very often for listeners who don't know how the business
works.
No,
it does not.
So, and at that point, I guess, or soon afterwards, the rest of the family gets on board, moves with you to LA, or was it sort of back and forth for a while?
It was back and forth for a while. It was actually, the first year or so, I was only auditioning for commercials, and I did a lot of commercials. Then when I was 11, I ended up doing this my first movie. And after that, things started, I guess, really picking up. But it wasn't until I was 12 that we officially made the move to LA. But during that time, we were still doing back and forth. My dad would come out with me, and then, you know, my sisters would stay home, and then we'd switch. It reached this point where we were like, well, and then it reached a point where we were like, well, actually the entire family really does love LA, and there's, you know, LA is just a lot of fun. Yeah. And I was also, you know, consistently, I continued to work, and that's when they decided, well, it's just too much on the family, so we either need to move back to Texas or we need to just pick one. So we picked LA.
Fortunately, yeah. Well, so I guess let's set the scene for when you're now actually living in LA. First of all, how did schooling work?
Schooling was always very important to my parents. Mm-hmm. Not as much to me. I was like, I don't need to do it. Obviously, I didn't really care about school until I got into high school. Then I, mm-hmm. then it became obviously more of a priority. But my parents were very, very strict about school and making sure that it was always number one on the list, and it was never secondary. So schooling was, I was homeschooled. Mm-hmm. I started homeschooling in fifth grade. I started mm-hmm. homeschooling, and it was just really just easy because I always had either my parents to do school with me or a studio teacher to do school with me. So it was always, it always seemed like a very easy thing to juggle school.
So there's a number of adjustments that have to have been going on at that point. You've moved out to LA, you are being schooled in a different way than before, educated in a different way. And then in a not so fun aspect of things that I've read about, it was about that same time, I think, that you had some difficult news that young people should not normally have to deal with just on a personal level. I don't know if you are comfortable getting into that, but I think it must have shaped you a lot.
It definitely did. It's actually interesting that you bring that up because it is the first thing I think about. I don't even remember what I was working on at the time, that's all I remember. And I think that speaks volumes in terms of like what I was dealing with at that age, but also just my entire family and my sisters too. But yeah, it was such a formative like area in my life. It was 12. I was 12 going on 13. We were living in this house. It was our first house that we were living in LA. You know, I think it was a lot.
We should say this was something that affected your mom.
Yes. So my mom got diagnosed with breast cancer, stage 4 breast cancer, when I was 12, and she was 39 years old. And it was a very, very scary time for me and obviously my entire family and my sister, my baby sister, who was, and I should say I have two sisters. Mm-hmm. Maddie is the middle one. She's now 21 years old. And my sister Jane is the baby of the family. And at the time she was only 5 years old. Mm-hmm. So all of it, I think I didn't realize how much I was going through mentally. Yeah. And I think the one thing that allowed me to step away from all of it was acting and going to work. And I was able to really find, I guess, relief in my life with acting, which is actually not something I normally, well, I guess acting in general is sort of it can be a release in many different ways, but for me in particular during that time, it was definitely it was something that was just very convenient. I had my grandma actually came and lived with us to just mm-hmm. help out around yeah. the house, and she was taking me to work. I now remember what I was working on. I was working on Justified.
Yes.
At the time.
Which, your first really big project, right? Your first notable role.
Yeah. I loved Justified, man. It was such a, wow. We can get into that, but yeah. I mean, it was a big time in my life, but I think we always remember the hardest moments in life are the ones we remember most and are somewhat beautiful in a way. Cause you get through it somehow, but yeah, it was a lot.
And just, I guess I of course have to ask, was your mom okay? Did she make it through that?
Yeah, she's, she actually had a PET scan today, just a couple hours ago. She's actually all right now. She is, she went through 5 years of remission, of being in remission. And she didn't get anything for 5 years, and we went and celebrated, and everything was great. And she nothing had come back within those 5 years, which the doctors say that that's a really good sign, because then you're cured. But then within that year, they found a small amount that came back. So we are now just working to get rid of that at the moment. Mm-hmm. So she's definitely a lot better than what she used to be, for sure. But it's always a little bit of a stressful, nerve-wracking.
Well, I feel for you, actually, because I, at about the same age, my dad had his own cancer diagnosis with a different type of melanoma. But it was, I know that I found that, and I'm also, I think, did you say you're the oldest of the mm-hmm. kids?
Yeah.
Yeah, same with me. And I think you do assume, I think it's got to really, it makes you grow up faster than you otherwise would have. And I wonder, for my, I'm sure it affected me in its own way, but I wonder for you, do you think that, you mentioned that acting was a sort of a release, but do you also think that you channeled what you were going through in your acting? Did it make you a better actor to have experienced so many different crazy emotions at such a young age?
I think so. I think definitely, definitely. I remember always sort of hiding the way I actually felt, because I wanted to, like you said, I had two little sisters, and one, my youngest sister didn't even quite I don't think she even really understood how intense it all was. I don't think she really understood that. So for me, I felt like I had to take the initiative and take charge and be strong for just them, but also for my mom and for my dad. And doing that for a while definitely makes a difference on you. And I think that coupled with the fact that I was working with really only adults, my entire teen years, I think it definitely made me grow up a lot faster.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about some of the work you were doing while this was going on in the background. And you mentioned Justified. This was playing Loretta, a Kentucky teen who gets into some dark stuff of her own.
Yeah.
This was from 2011 to 2015, recurring roles, that season 2, 3, 5, and 6. And I guess, just your overall thoughts when you look back at that, but also the person, I'm curious what you can say about the person who I think you worked with probably as much as anyone, one of the great character actresses that's out there, and that is Margot Martindale.
Margot Martindale is just, will always be, she will always hold such a special, special place in my heart, because she just really, she really taught me what it's like to be so good at what you do and such a good person at the same time. And you don't ever have to have an ego at any point, and that everyone is an equal on set. And there are, there are ways to just do your job well and also just be nice. and she taught me that. And I was constantly, there was no just like, there was no like really specific pieces of advice that I was getting from anyone at Justified, but being surrounded by constant love and support and genuine, like, just camaraderie and, like, and teamwork that was really, really, like, genuine and came from a place of passion. I mean, it was, I really, to this day, Justified is the best job I've ever had. I don't know why. I think it was the people, though. I mean, yes, I loved playing Loretta. It was playing that role was such a new thing for me. I had never really explored character work before. I had never gotten to be someone so tough, so young. And that was exciting for me, that alone. But going to work and just being surrounded by all of those people that just really just loved being at work and were constantly joking around. I mean, it was a dark show, too. It was a mm-hmm. really dark show. It could get really, really heavy. And they were just so much fun, all of those people. And it literally is my favorite thing in the world to talk about them and talk about that show, because I just love all of them so much. And I'm so grateful that I was able to. I was just talking about this to someone the other day who is also on Justified. And I was just like, we were both talking about it so much. So I'm like, isn't it just so cool that we're a part of that club? Like, there's not a lot of people that get to be a part of that club. I feel like I'd even be so excited if I had one line on the show. It's just so cool to be a part of the Justified club.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's showing up on lists of all-time greatest shows already. And it hasn't even been off, you know, for very long yet. So, but meanwhile, you had a couple other TV projects that started that same year, or at least went on the air that same year, that I have to just at least touch upon. And the other one was a very different kind of show, sitcom. You're playing Eve Baxter, the daughter of Tim Allen's character, on Last Man Standing. This was a main role from seasons 1 through 6, and then it's been recurring since then. I think you were 13 when you started on that, and I want to ask you about, you mentioned that you'd had a little bit of this simulated sitcom experience in Dallas, which was interesting, but now you're literally having to do this in front of an audience, which must to some degree feel like theater, except that you're having to learn new lines every day or whatever, however often, right?
Yes. It was so cool being cast in that show. The process from the very beginning was just cool. I remember I went in for my audition, and then I got a call back, and then I did this thing like the network tests, yes, that you go to, and you have to sign, you know, the next 7 years, you know, the next 7 years that day before you go in and do your network test. And all of it was so, so exciting. And it was, again, it was so new. I was experiencing so many new things at that time in my life. It was a lot of, I think I was being overstimulated with the amount of things that were going on. Yeah. Now that I'm like really thinking about it, there was a lot going on. But again, I doing that show was again so much of an escape for me. And it was such a, surprisingly, looking back on it, it was such a huge learning experience for me. I mean, Justified definitely was, but I think that Last Man Standing was really a really big one. And I say that because I gained so much confidence on that show. And I used to be, you know, kind of afraid to improv. I wasn't really confident because I felt like, oh, what if it's not funny, or they might get angry if I say something extra or whatever. On that show, I was able to really just trust my own instincts and to realize that, like, people love it when you riff. People really enjoy, you know, authenticity, and they even love it. The crowd, like, when you do the sitcom, the live audience, like, they love it when you laugh too. And it's, yes, okay to break. It's okay to, like, break and have a good time. And just, it really just taught me to be really loose, and it relaxed me a bit. And I think it was because of, you know, the advice Tim Allen was giving me, combined with the repetition of it all. You know, it was just the same thing over and over and over and over and over again. And doing the table reads every Wednesday. We still do them every Wednesday. When I go back, it's Wednesday, 10 a.m. And having that kind of routine, coupled with the fact that that's when I started high school. And all of it was just, it worked out so great doing that show. And then they allowed me to do, you know, film on the side. And I'm just really grateful for that show. They were so, and they're so, they're like my second family over there. They were just the best.
Yeah. I mean, it's been a presence in your life. I guess that would be for almost 10 years. That's a unusually long period for a young person to have been involved with something. But yeah. The third of the 2011 TV places where people might have seen you on TV, this is a much shorter relationship than you had with the other shows, but it was just the one episode.
I'm not sure what you're going to say.
I rewatched it last night because I remembered it and I just wanted to make sure it was as funny as I remembered. And it is. And that is your one appearance on Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Yes.
And let me set it up and then ask you to take it away. But basically, you are playing a Girl Scout who visits Larry David to try to sell some cookies. And while in his doorway, experiences her first period, which obviously, as always on Curb Your Enthusiasm, leads to plenty of delightful awkwardness. So what was, you know, just you talk about improv and probably coming in and being funny. Talk about that one.
Yes, I remember getting the audition. I would take my auditions very seriously also. Most of the time I would dress the part. I would go out with my mom and find, if I didn't have like a Girl Scout thing, I'd go and find something that looked like one. I took my auditions very seriously, and I remember like Googling Girl Scout cookie names because I was never a Girl Scout. And I wanted to know all of the names because I thought that they had like really funny, and it would be funny if I could just sit there and list all of them. And I did. And I went in for my audition, and it was extremely scary. You know, Larry David was in the audition room and they wanted me to improv right then and there. And I remember Jeff Garland being in there, and it was just like, it was very nerve-wracking. Then I ended up getting it, and I remember all of that moved very quickly. A lot, I'd get onto set sometimes, and things would just move so, so quickly. And then some other days, it would be like I'd be sitting in school for 5 hours and not get called until, you know, 6 hours after my call time or whatever. But, like, sometimes it would move really, really fast. So with that, I actually learned not to get so settled so quickly. Like, I think that basically I learned that anything can happen in a second. So with that, they just sort of like put me on. I remember I met Jeff and I was reintroduced to Larry David, and then they put me behind the door and they shut the door and they said, okay, let's go. And it was very much like you see it in the movies when they're like, you know, reenacting a movie within a movie. They're like, okay, and this is the this is Hollywood. This is how it goes. And it's literally what it felt. I'm like, oh, Hollywood's too fast for me. And I remember they shut the door, and I was like, oh, and I was just like going over everything in my head, and I was thinking, wait a second. I don't know. I like, if I want to refer to him, like, who does he play on the show? I had never seen the show. I don't think I was allowed to watch the show. And I had never seen the show. So I was like, ugh, what's his name on the show? And I remember turning to one of the camera guys who was behind me. I think we were rolling already. And I said, does he play Larry on the show? Is his name Larry on the show? Right before I had to go in. That's great. And then it was like, done. I remember doing like two or three takes, totally improv'd, and then it was done. And
that was hilarious.
It was the best. It was so fun. It was so fun.
So you mentioned that it was around that same time that you were, I think, starting to be allowed to go and do movies as well. And one of them, I'm going to mention, you know, some of these early things you're working for Clint Eastwood and J. Edgar, which is that must have been pretty I don't know if you knew who Clint Eastwood was. I mean, that might, but it would be intimidating if you did.
Yeah, I mean, it was intimidating because I think Clint Eastwood's name just alone, you know. I mean, I hadn't, at that point, I don't know if I had seen any of his films yet, but just, I knew it was a big deal. That was a crazy time as well. Yeah.
That was one of the early ones. Another one, Spectacular Now. You're the, just to remind folks, I guess first we should say in J. Edgar, you were the Attorney General's daughter in the Spectacular Now for James Ponsell. You're the best friend of this character who's played by Shailene Woodley, who gets into some hot water. You're the very protective best friend. But the first one where I remember really noticing and being blown away by you was Short Term 12, which, like, anyone who saw that when it came out in 2013, you know, it was just, you knew that this entire cast was going to go on to very big things. And here we are, not even, you know, I guess 7 years later. And it's true. This was the breakout role for Brie Larson, Rami Malek, Lakeith Stanfield, and yourself, and one of the breakout roles for you. And I wonder how you first heard about it and when you did, if it was clear even on the page that this was going to be a really special one.
Yeah, I knew immediately when I read that script that it was special. I didn't know that, you know, I didn't realize the impact it would have on people at the time. I did know that it was special, and I knew that when I met Destin that he was a very special person and that it was a story that was very important to him. So all of that put together, I knew that it was going to be something really, really incredible. I remember it was one of the hardest auditions I've had to do still. It's not easy being in a small confined space in front of, you know, a guy working the camera, the casting director, and the director. And then you have to do these, you know, heartbreaking scenes, these emotionally draining scenes. Just,
we should say for listeners that you're playing this girl, Jaden, who was among many young people, teenagers in this group facility, being counseled by also very young people, but just a few years older. And I mean, one of the things that emerges from this, and I'm guessing this maybe was even the scene that they had you audition for, I don't know. But the one, when I think of that movie and your character, you and Brie Larson are sitting in a room and you ask to share a story about that you've written about an octopus. And it basically, she reads between the lines that you have been through some very bad things. And so I don't know if that was the scene they had you do, but that's the one that stays with me the most.
Yeah, it stays with me too. And it is the scene that I did for my audition. That and Jaden's meltdown. There is also a moment in the film where she has a pretty bad breakout scene. And it involved a lot of screaming and crying and yelling and name calling, and it was a lot. And those two were, I think I had three, I can't remember my third scene, but those two were in my audition. And I also remember getting that story, and I remember I don't like to use my sides in auditions, and I also I had gotten the scene, like, I think it was right, they had added that scene right before my callback, so I wrote it down on a piece of paper, kind of like Jaden has in the movie, and I put it in my pocket, and then I pulled it out and I read from it. And it was definitely the hardest audition I've ever had to do in my life. And then the movie itself was, I remember it being such a family oriented set, and there was so much love on that set, and there was such a good positive energy given the material that we were doing every day. It was still just a really nice place to go to work at. And it was really weird for me to go from the sitcom. I was literally going, the sitcom was so awesome. They let me go from shooting the show like Wednesday through Friday to then shooting short term on the weekends.
Wow.
And then I'd go back to the sitcom on Monday, Tuesday, and that's when we did our tape nights. And then on our hiatus weeks, I would shoot Short Term 12. But I think I shot all of my scenes in 14 days. I think for me, it was a 14-day shoot. I think total, it may have been a little more than 20 days, 24, 20. I can't remember, but it was a short shoot, really quick. And you would think that that would make things like super high stress and intense and high strung. And it wasn't. And I think it was all because of Destin, our director, and how much of a calm soul he is. He's just so calm. He's just the sweetest guy in the world. And he was always so supportive of everyone. And he's the best. I mean, it was such a really just an amazing group of people. And I'm so happy for everything they're doing now. It's crazy to see where everyone has gone. They've gone on to do just such amazing things.
Well, if people haven't seen it yet, I hope they leave this podcast when it's over and go and check it out immediately. I think it's on Netflix now, but certainly can be tracked down. And, you know, my testament to it is that when I have industry related friends who I need to give a gift to, I bought a bunch of copies of DVDs where it's like my 10 favorite movies of the 21st century. Oh. And it's sort of like a little gift.
That's an amazing gift.
I didn't know what else to do. But anyway, Short Term 12 is always in that. And I think people will feel that way. But it does seem like after starting with that movie and ever since, a lot of your films have dealt with social issues, just, you know, issues plaguing society. And I wonder if that is purely coincidental, or did you come out of that feeling, you know, movies can be more than just entertaining. Maybe I like telling stories that can, in their own way, make a difference. Do you think it's a causal thing?
Yeah, I think for me, it's that the interest in doing that started with Short Term 12. But really, you know, since I've done Unbelievable, I have really been thinking about that. I mean, I think about it a lot. I think about the reason why I wanted to be an actor in the first place. And, you know, obviously I want to do acting because I just love it. And I just have so much fun with it. It's just literally just a fun, fun thing for me to do. And I have so much passion for it. But if I'm able to do something fun and do some good and you know, give a voice to the voiceless or be a part of telling a story that was somewhat buried, all of that combined together is just so much more than I could ever dream of. So yeah, it's definitely that interest began with Short Term 12, but then even since then, it's just increased, and I want to continue to be a part of stories like that, stories that deserve to be told.
And as I ask you about a few of these others that were in between Short Term 12 and Unbelievable, I think listeners will see that it comes up again. I mean, Men, Women, and Children for Jason Reitman, which was a year after Short Term 12, 2014, has its own look at the ways we in society are affected by the internet in different ways. And I wonder, I guess, your experience working with him as someone who had a lot of success working with another teen in Juno with Ellen Page just a few years before. But also, I think it was on that project, from what I've read, that you started doing something that you do on every project since that may involve music.
Yeah. I was just on Zoom last night with Jason. He gets friends together to play Zoom games, this game called Codenames. So he's been inviting me to play Codenames, and it's been so much fun. It's so exciting to do in quarantine. Jason is and forever will be one of my greatest supporters and friends. He's just literally the greatest I know. I could really talk about him all day. He's ever since Men, Women, and Children, from that moment on, I've really, really looked up to him But I also, I know that I can go to him with anything, with any question, and he will be there. And that's something that I think is, you know, with all the craziness that comes with being involved in the industry, it's just, it's really, really incredible to know that, like, he's got my back and I've got his. And I don't know, I just really admire him, and I think he's the best. But on that movie in particular, was the first time I realized how helpful music can be in character development. And I would have never thought of that, and if it weren't for Jason. And I have, you're right, I have used that method every single time now for character development. And I remember,
is it just sort of like a playlist for a character?
Yeah, I mean he emailed the entire cast and said, what is your character's favorite song? What do you think your character's favorite song would be right now? And I think that is so, it's so incredible to think about. I had never even thought about that. And it's true. If I were to think about the song that I'm listening to nonstop right now, it's sort of it would describe how I'm feeling right now and where I'm at mentally. And I think that yeah, I've since then I have created playlists for every character that I do. And it's so helpful. So helpful.
Let's go to the next big movie, which I think would maybe be Detroit, as one of a couple of young white women who are found with a couple of young black men at the Algiers Motel on the night when Detroit really blows up, basically. And this was directed by Catherine Bigelow, coming off of The Hurt Locker and Zero Dark Thirty, and just amazing stuff. A, working with a female director, I'm not sure that's something that had happened for you before, and B, on a pretty intense shoot. Anything that you take away from that one?
Yeah, I was so excited to work with another woman. I just have to give a shout out to Lynn Shelton. She's also one of the greats. Laggies. Yes. She's amazing. I love her so, so much. So I was definitely excited to work with, I'm always excited to work with women. I need to work with more and more and more women. Catherine Bigelow is just like Catherine Bigelow. I mean, it's just there. What else do you need to say? She literally floats through set. And especially it was so shocking to me being on the set of Detroit, and just her sense of calm was so infectious, and it was just so helpful to be around that kind of energy. And that was a very intense, very, very intense shoot, but it was always a good time with the entire cast, 'cause we would try to, you know, escape, you know, a hard day's work and just sort of like go out at night. We were shooting in Boston, and I met my best friend on that shoot, and that was such a cool summer. But really working with Catherine Bigelow, I think, is like almost it is bucket list material.
Okay, so that leads up to 2018. There were two big movies on the Fall Film Fest circuit that people saw you in. One of them was The Front Runner, as the daughter of Gary Hart, I believe, is the, and then also Beautiful Boy as the girlfriend of the drug addicted character played by Timothée Chalamet. And I just remember feeling so awful about watching your character. It's like in a slow motion train wreck happening. But I guess it seems like you and Timothy, and actually you've worked with a lot of this wave of young people, whether it was Ansel Elgort with Spectacular Now, or any number of the you know, sort of your contemporaries who have really blown up in the last couple of years. I guess it sounds like Timothy was somebody you enjoyed working with.
I love Timothy. He's the most talented person in the world. I think the world of Timothy. I think he's so incredibly talented. You know, I met him, I had known him since I was 16, because we did Men, Women, and Children. And
right.
Yeah, he's always been the best. He has never changed, and he's only just getting better with age. I guess not really age because we're still young here, but no, I'm always going to be in awe of him. He's always surprising me with his work, and doing that with him was such a fun little trip to San Francisco. And living in the San Francisco world for like 2 weeks. And I was so happy to be able to do that kind of movie with him because it was so, again, another heavy film, another intense character to play. And I was so glad to have a real, like, genuine friend with me on that journey. It was so fun.
Okay, so this brings us up to what must have been a pretty insane last year for you. And let's start with one of the first of the two big projects. Amy, the brilliant young lesbian high school senior in Olivia Wilde's directorial debut, Booksmart. People may not realize that you were attached to this, though, years before Olivia or Beanie Feldstein or just about anyone else. And I wonder, how did it first cross your radar and why did it take so long to come to fruition?
Yeah, I genuinely think, I mean, we talk about this a lot, but I genuinely think society just had to catch up with it. And I read it, I guess, now 6 years ago, but when we made it, I had read it 5 years prior, 4 or 5 years prior. It was a script that I immediately fell in love with and also immediately thought, oh, well, this is going to someone else.
Just because you hadn't really necessarily played the lead in something before?
No, yeah, exactly. I kept running into this problem, this problem of, you know, wanting to do these roles in these movies and people telling me I couldn't because I hadn't before. Mm-hmm. Which I understand, but then I'm like, all right, so then how do I cross that step of then doing it so that I have done it before?
Right.
And Annapurna and everyone on that team were the people that said, yeah, we'll be those people and we'll take a chance on you.
Because you'd already dealt with them on Detroit. Is that how they knew you?
I guess so. I knew that Booksmart was still happening at the time, but then Detroit happened. And yes, I did know all of the Annapurna peeps when I went in for my audition. But yeah, it was a script that I knew needed to be made. And I just loved it from the very moment I read it. But again, it was like that feeling of, well, okay, I do love this role, Amy, this and Molly and Amy's friendship. But I was kind of negative about it just because I thought, oh, well, I don't know. I don't think they'll, you know, I don't know. I wasn't sure. And I went into a meeting with Annapurna and they told me right then and there. I was expecting to, you know, go on 5 auditions to play Amy and fight for it. And they just told me that they wanted me to play Amy right in that meeting. And that was the first time that it ever happened. And they just, I don't know. It was just right then and there, that's what happened. And then from that moment on the project, I think 2 years, it was 2 years later that Olivia came on. And then I was in a meeting, my first meeting with Olivia Wilde, and she said, this movie cannot be made without Beanie Feldstein as your as your partner in crime. And I about fell over because I am in love with her and I love Lady Bird. And we had the greatest time on that movie. And I was so excited that it just got made. And then now it's made me even more excited to see the love that it just continually gets is just mind-blowing to me, and it just so special. I can't even begin to say.
Well, I think people should also realize it's not like this was a big budget movie. I think and you guys shot it in 26 days from what I've read, and you know, as we said, Olivia's first time really at the helm, and it seems like she honed in on something maybe from her own experience as an actress that helped to foster your and Beanie's
chemistry. It sounds like you guys would have gotten along anyway, but this really just different things I've read about, like sending you out on different fun things to do together. And then I guess it was your idea that maybe also live together during the shoot, just stuff like that. Do you think that the fact that she's also an actress herself, Olivia, you know, makes her a different sort of director for you than people who aren't?
I definitely think so. I think there's, you know, when I think having been an actor, she just has such an amazing understanding of what that's like. And she refers to movie sets and film sets as like basically construction sites. There's just so much going on all the time. And it actually is really hard to focus on then, okay, you're in the van and then you're out of the van and you're brought to set and then you have people touching you up and hair and makeup people fixing your hair and then there's all this other stuff going on and then you're supposed to like do a scene where you're yelling at your best friend and it's the most upsetting thing that has ever happened to you or happened to your character in their life. And so it's just a lot. And I think that's one thing that she really, I mean, one of many things that she really, really gets is how chaotic a set can be. And she is able to really, really take care of all of her actors because of that, I think. And she's also just been on so many different sets and she's been able to really pull from the good and the bad and create sort of the best set you could possibly be on. It was literally the best. It was literally like summer camp, but the best summer camp you've ever been to kind of movie set. It really was just, oh my God, it was so much fun. And that was because of Liv. She had snacks everywhere. She had music going. Everyone was just hanging out because they wanted to. There were a lot of people who had been wrapped and they were like, all right, you can go home now. And people still wouldn't go home.
Well, I think it was, it's interesting that you and Beanie, I think both went off from that project to do the first films that you solo, or first projects really that you solo were the leads of.
Yeah.
And I wonder, you know, it sounds like you heard about yours, which is unbelievable, the limited series in which you're playing this young woman, Marie Adler, who's charged with lying about being raped. It sounds like you heard about that towards the end of Booksmart. So I guess if you can share about how, you know, the difference with Booksmart, it had been years to think about what you were going to do with that. Now you've got a pretty quick turnaround to play what's got to be the heaviest character you've ever played. And just if you can connect the dots from catching wind of this at the end of Booksmart to actually going to work playing this very dark story.
Yeah, it really was just it threw me, that one, because it came into my life very, very quickly. It came in actually to my email inbox on my last week of filming Booksmart. And you're very right by saying like there was so much lead up time for Booksmart and there was so much anticipation for shooting that movie. And I just wanted it to be made so bad. And then it finally was being made. And I'm like, oh, this is so much fun. And I got so caught up and distracted and just how much fun I was having making Booksmart. And then towards like the ending of the shoot, I started getting the classic actor panic, which is basically just me worrying about, okay, what the heck am I going to be working on next? Because I have nothing to work on. And there are so many, this was such a high and I was getting myself ready for a low and to not work. Cause that's literally just what happens all the time. You get through a lot of work and then sometimes you just don't work at all. And so this came at such a very convenient time, but also it was the most, heartbreaking story I had ever read. And I remember going over my audition, you know, while I was still, you know, doing, you know, filming Booksmart, and then I would go over my audition, and that was kind of a juggle as well. But I'd say the audition for Short Term 12 and also the audition for Unbelievable were the two hardest auditions I've ever had in my life. And I knew that I wanted to work. I had been dying to work with Toni Collette my entire life. I saw her in The Sixth Sense when I was 9 or 10, and I remember thinking that was really the moment where I was like, "This is exactly what I want to be doing. This is whatever she is doing. That is what I want to do." And so I thought, "Oh, I have to. I am dying to work with Toni Collette and Merritt Weaver and everyone involved in the project." There were some producers from Justified were producing Unbelievable, and it was just the hardest role I've ever had to play. But playing Marie Adler, it was so rewarding. It felt so good to be a part of something like that, and something that was so incredibly important. And you know, I think we say a lot that it is a very relevant story. It's a very timely story, but it actually, you know, sexual assault is actually something that has been going on forever and ever and ever. And it's been such an issue for such a long time that affects people for the rest of their lives. And it's something that I think we've sort of, you know, forgotten about. And we also haven't seen this kind of story done in this way. So when I was signing on to do it, there were so many things that were just so moving to me. One of them being the fact that the creatives wanted to shoot the sexual assault scene from Marie's point of view. And I think, you know, while it's really, really, you know, heartbreaking and hard to watch, there are so many elements to the story that allowed people to really think about sexual assault in a very different way and to learn from it. And so it feels really good to know that it's impacted people in a really big way and that people are really, really learning from it. And also I you know, just the prep alone was, I sort of just had to forget about myself and know that I was doing this. We were all doing this for Marie and to tell her story in the best way possible. And I think it was just totally worth it. Totally worth it.
Yeah.
Can you talk about, I mean, I guess, was it an option to meet with the real Marie? Was that something you wanted to do or were able to do? I wondered because I could see the pros and cons of that.
Yeah, it's something I did bring up to Susanna Grant and Lisa Cholodenko, our director. Well, Susanna Grant also directed the last two episodes, and she's just a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant human. I talked to them about the idea of doing that, and we had a discussion about it. And I you know, it was so clear to me how much of a privilege it was that Marie was even allowing us to tell her story in such a big way. And this is, again, something that is still, you know, she's still alive and out in the world. And I feel like, you know, obviously this is something that affects someone for the rest of their life. And I wanted to be very careful of that and to know how incredibly hard it must be to just think about it, to talk about it. And so for that reason, I decided that I had a lot of information about Marie and a lot of source material on her. And so I felt like I had enough as an actor to be able to dive in. And I really just wanted to do what she was comfortable with. And that was really all that mattered to me. Yeah.
So when you now went to work actually shooting this thing, I was really curious how that logistically worked, because I don't think you've ever necessarily bitten off that much at once. Yeah, you've done TV series that you're part of for years and years, but not in such a short amount of time, having to do so much where you're in essentially almost every scene. And I just wonder, is it done episode by episode? Is it done in sequence? How do you have to, like, basically chart out your whole character development? I wondered about that watching it.
It was really interesting to try to plan something. And I tried, and I think I quickly learned that there was no use in planning. There is no set formula to be able to do something like that. It was really cool. I just want to say that it was really cool to be able to, you know, lead a film like Booksmart with one of my best friends, Beanie Feldstein, and for the two of us to be able to like hold each other's hand and to have each other's backs hardcore, and then to go on, you know, she went on to do How to Build a Girl, which is out May 8th, and and I went on to do Unbelievable, and it was just very, very special. But yeah, preparing for that and trying to think of you know, the best way to go about it. It really was just really what was just important to me was just making sure I was keeping Marie as the priority and thinking about what she went through and trusting what I had done, trusting the work I had put in and the prep I had put in prior to filming. I put a lot of pressure on myself, so much pressure on myself that I would get really, really nervous because I didn't want to screw it up for her. I thought like, these people are giving me this opportunity. Like, wow, I cannot take it for granted. And I have to do this right for her. So it was really all about just keeping that in check and remembering that whatever headache I have from crying all day and how exhausted I am at the end of a work day, it doesn't even compare to what she felt in real life. And then also just accidentally too, I wasn't planning on staying in it, but I really did stay in it. And by in it, I mean staying in the emotion of it all. And I stayed in that same mental state for the 4 months we were shooting the show for. And I really didn't mean to. I am not one to do method acting. I am such a goof on set, and I still was, but I remember feeling everything so intensely during that time and really allowing myself to stay in it. Cause again, I just felt like this is happening for a reason. I just need to go with it. I think it was a lot of that too. It was a lot of just like going with it and trusting myself on that one.
Was there one day, one scene that you particularly found the most challenging for you?
Yeah, I think a lot of days were really, really challenging. A lot. I think the hardest part of the whole series was the first three episodes, just because there's just so much going on in Marie's life at that point that we were shooting all of those intense, intense scenes. I think the day we were at the we were shooting at the police station and I was doing all of my interviews with the detectives, that was probably like one of the more exhausting couple of days out of the entire shoot, because it was a lot. And it was also just a lot of like emotional curveballs that were being thrown at me. Like, this was another cool thing about doing the show, is that there were so many incredible actors I was working with, that there were a lot of like surprising things that were happening. Like, I guess things that I had, or ways I had expected to feel during a certain scene, and then feeling a completely different way just because of how the actor was acting. And it was so cool to be able to then shift what I had originally thought was going to be the way it was going to go, and then completely shift the way I was doing it. And it actually being for the better, because it was so authentic and real and organic. But it was, though, the detective scenes were very, very, those were really hard days. I think we carved out like 2 days to do all of them, and it was a lot. It was,
wow.
Yeah, I remember all the drives home I remember me driving home from those days and just feeling like I have like a weight of bricks or like a ton of bricks just like off of my body and my face sore and from crying and it was intense.
I mean, the thing that people say about that series now is that they had never really seen anything like it, right? There was to have it from the perspective of the victim and the survivor, however you describe what she's been through. And I guess the other thing, though, is that it's clarified or it's forced people to think about their idea of what it means to, you know, how they think about people who come forward with these kinds of allegations and may not, you know, there may be some behavior that to you or I or to the average person may not seem to line up in fully. But I guess maybe if you just want, I wondered if you wanted to just close the unbelievable portion here by just saying, you know, what you hope people take away from this in terms of understanding why that might be for someone in that position.
Yeah, I think we haven't as a society, we haven't really been properly educated how trauma can affect someone in such an insane way, but also how trauma affects people very, very, very differently. And there is no one set reaction. Everyone reacts to trauma differently because of how, you know, they've been brought up or many different ways. It's just, there is no set reaction. And I think that is one big thing that I have taken away. One of the many things that I have taken away from being a part of this experience. But we must, I mean, all I can say is that we just really, really, we must start believing survivors from the very beginning and not just, you know, set it aside. It needs to be talked about. It needs to be talked about.
All right. So with our last minute, I just want to end on a happier subject, which is where you find yourself at this point, having had this incredible year and maybe, you know, I think people in the business and people who cover it like me, we've known about you for years, but I think now a lot of other people are catching on. And so I wonder how you've handled all this, whether it's Golden Globe nomination day or Golden Globe night, or just generally now, I imagine you go out and, you know, maybe not during coronavirus, but prior to coronavirus,
yes,
you go
prior out
to the store. People probably, I would imagine probably a lot more people recognize you, have something to say. Maybe it's, I don't know if that's always fun, but just how have things been different since the world has gotten to see these two projects in which you've gotten to be front and center for the first time?
It's been like last year in particular was such a whirlwind experience, and everything that I had hoped for those two projects and more happened. Like the amount of love that I was seeing for both of them at the same time was just a lot. It was really, really, really overwhelming. And yeah, going to, you know, the Golden Globes for the first time was so overwhelming. I think the biggest thing for me is that I'm just getting to interact and talk to people that I really, really, really look up to. And I think that, you know, it's amazing that I get to, you know, see all of my favorite actors in movies and learn from them in that way. But then if I get to like meet them and talk to them, and for some of them to even reach out to me, you know, I've had some people like reach out to me that I have like literally looked up to forever that have told me they had just seen Booksmart, they just watched Unbelievable, they just binged Unbelievable on Netflix. And it's so mind-boggling to me. I mean, Malala reached out to me and Beanie over Twitter, and then like, what else do I need to do with my life? I can retire now. Or like Tom Hanks came up to me at the Golden Globes, was walking past me and just said hello and talked to me for 5 minutes. And I don't know. I that alone, I don't even, It's still, I think I'm still processing it is what I'm trying to say. Is what I'm trying to say. I'm still processing it. It's the come down is happening, and I'm doing a lot of reflecting, and I'm being forced to reflect even more because of this quarantine.
But it's been so cool. I will just end by saying that, it's been really fun. I've not been doing this that long, so to be able to say that I've seen somebody's whole career is a new thing for me, to say that I've covered and watched their whole career, and that's been fun. And even I doubt you'll remember this, but I remember moderating a Q&A. This was about 5 or 6 years ago in Sherman Oaks at the Arclight related to Birdman. And I believe you, and it maybe was your sister, came up to me afterwards, and I had a little chat at that point. And I was just my thing is I was impressed not only with your acting, but with just like you've handled this all so impressively. So I'm just happy that it's all seems to be coming together. And it's been, I didn't get to say that to you during this Oscar season, which bothered me because I kept seeing Olivia, but not you.
No.
But, so anyway, just congratulations and keep it up. Enjoy it.
Thank you so much. This has been, I just want to say thank you to you because you've always been such a supporter of me and everything that I've done, and you're just the best. And I've really enjoyed this talk. It's been really nice.
My pleasure. Well, stay safe out there, and hopefully we'll all get back to work soon.
Yes, please.
All right. Well, you take care. Thanks again.
Bye.
Thanks very much for tuning in to Awards Chatter. We really appreciate you taking the time to do that, and would really appreciate you taking a minute more to subscribe to our podcast for free on iTunes or your podcast app, and to leave us a rating as well. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can reach me via Twitter at twitter.com/ScottFeinberg, and you can follow all of my coverage between episodes at thr.com/TheRace. Finally, be sure to check out the other podcasts that are part of the Hollywood Reporter's podcast network, all of which are excellent. Leslie Goldberg and Daniel Feinberg's TV's Top 5, Seth Abramovich and Chip Pope's It Happened in Hollywood, Carolyn Giardina's Behind the Screen, and Josh Wigler's Series Regular. On behalf of all of us at The Hollywood Reporter, thanks for tuning in.